This is the sermon that was delivered on December 16th, 2012 at Cornerstone Fellowship in Urbana. At least a good part of it anyway. I want to start off by talking a little bit about the events recently in Connecticut, the shooting of the children. Many people are seeing it on the news and are affected by it and are thinking about it. A lot of churches are talking about it. And I want to talk about that tonight as well. In 2008, which is the last year I was able to find reliable statistics for, there were 925 children being under the age of 15, 925 children who were murdered in the United States. 406 of these children were killed by guns. That's a very large number of children to die in 1 year, just 1 year, from gunfire. More than one a day. And that number, by the way, excludes accidents and suicides. Now, the awful events in Connecticut are just unimaginably horrible. The number of kids killed, the planned malevolence on display, the age of the kids, all these things are just too terrible to contemplate. I've certainly shed some tears about it this week as well, as have many of you. And we will pray for them, and should pray for them. But there's something about this that disturbs me too on a national level, something that goes beyond just the tragedy itself, but more to the heart of our reaction to it. Because there are kids being shot pretty much every day in this country, and we don't see it splashed across the headlines. And I have to wonder why that is. Well, if you look a little more closely at the statistics, it says that over 80% of these children who are shot are found to be killed in what is termed gang-related, quote-unquote, incidents of violence. And I take from that that they're probably largely in the community, a minority community, probably in an impoverished living area. Probably a lot of the murders are drug-related, or revenge killings or something of that nature. And you turn back to the murders in Connecticut. How many times have you read as the header to all these articles on CNN and Fox News, New York Times, everywhere, that you read that, adjectives about Newtown, like quiet, wealthy, peaceful, safe, welcoming, sleepy, protected town of Newtown, Connecticut. And the shock here, I think, for the general middle class and general white public, the shock is that no one is safe. And it's the same shock that Columbine sent through the nation, that money and security and quote-unquote a good neighborhood, and all the things that we think make us safe all the time do not make anyone safe all of the time. Just like 9/11. 9/11 didn't change the world. I don't know how many times I heard that, 9/11 changed the world. You know, it didn't change anything. The world was exactly as it had always been, unless we thought somehow we were protected from violence forever and ever and ever. And this is a good time here, after this tragedy in Connecticut. It's a good time to reflect that every year in this country, literally, not figuratively, literally, hundreds of children are gunned down. It's so prevalent and so common that our communal outrage is dulled at best, and usually just even absent. These murders are buried in some back page of, you know, the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune. We hardly notice them. So the world hasn't changed, not one iota. This will not be the last tragedy. This won't be the last killing of children. It just came into the spotlight with a vengeance. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be shocked and saddened by what happened in Connecticut. I want to be very careful with that. It shakes me to the core that this happened. But the nationwide grieving process somehow troubles me, because I think we bring some of God's judgment on ourselves when we, white middle-class Americans, shout from the mountaintops that these children were killed brutally and it cannot be tolerated, but there's barely a whisper for the children of those who live under siege in the ghettos and slums across this country. That, to me, is deeply troubling. So I don't know where we go from here. I'm not saying don't grieve for these children. Obviously, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying go and uncover all those back page newspaper articles for every child shot last year and grieve equally for them, because that wouldn't do any good. And besides, we're not designed to carry the weight of all the murder in the world upon our hearts. I don't know that I really have any practical advice at all, but that as Christians, that we go on knowing that Yahweh is still Lord of the earth, but Satan is always its prince, and that sin is always with us. And this is but one atrocity of billions that have been continually with us since Cain slew Abel. You know, we worship not because all is well in the world, or we don't worship because we think we're safe. We worship because God is good. Someday earth and heaven will come together and put an end to all this madness and all this sorrow. And the scriptures here in front of us remind us time and time again that we should never mistake God's patience for his absence. His word can take centuries to be fulfilled, millennia even. So I want to turn now to the passage, which is, we'll start with the very end of 1 Kings chapter 16, and move on to the story of 1 Kings chapter 17. And we are actually going to start with the murder of children, and I didn't plan it this way. Actually, I've been working on the sermon when I heard about what happened in Connecticut. It segues on its own. But we start with the murder of two kids at the end of chapter 16, and I think this is one of those unfortunate chapter breaks between 16 and 17 that I really think chapter 17 should start on verse 34 of chapter 16, where it starts in Ahab's time, because I think that really is the story of Elijah that begins there. Because with the murder of these two kids, Elijah is outraged and speaks up. First, a little backstory. We talked a little bit last week about the pagan gods, and about, in particular, the Canaanite gods, which were also the Phoenician gods, and how child sacrifice played such a tremendous role in those religions. And that's we know that not just from the Bible, but from Roman and Greek sources, and also from archaeology. Most notably, the largest infant burial ground in the world known to man is at Carthage, where the Phoenicians who founded that city from Canaanite culture killed thousands and thousands and thousands of their children and cremated them, burned them, possibly burned them alive, actually. According to Roman sources, that was one of the ways that they were sacrificed, and then sacrificed to gods. So, here we are in Israel, where, of course, this sort of thing is not supposed to happen at all. It starts in verse 34. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. And that's a prophecy back from the book of Joshua. When Jericho was conquered, Joshua said, if anyone rebuilds it, it'll be at the cost of their children, which was a warning of sorts, but the warning even takes on a more macabre tone here, because the children are not slain by enemy warriors, or they didn't get ill and die. What the passage indicates here is that they were sacrificed. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn and set up its gates at the cost of his youngest. We know that there were instances back in ancient times where children were sacrificed when a building was built to appease the god, to request from the gods blessing upon that building to make it strong and impregnable to enemies. Sometimes the children were buried alive. And that may be what happened here, is that he buried alive his firstborn under the foundation and buried alive his youngest under the gates. Perhaps not. Maybe he was sacrificed another way. We don't really know. But at any rate, it seems clear that Hael Bethel, in his rebuilding of Jericho, sacrificed his two sons to pagan gods to strengthen these gates. And as you can see, this is just indicative of how far down the road of pagan worship Israel has gone. They're basically just adopting all the practices of the Canaanites, even the ones that are the most odious. So we get to chapter 17. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there'll be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Now, there's a few things that we note right away here. Elijah from Tishbe in Gilead, he's sort of from the boonies, he's out in the country area. Doesn't give him any backstory as to who his parents were or what background he had or anything. Chances are he probably came from a relatively poor family with something of an unknown. It was just the Spirit of the Lord upon him and the power that he had that gave him notice, as it was, in the world. Somehow, and the text does not relate how, he gains audience with Ahab, or gains Ahab's ear, and tells him, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there'll be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word." Now, there's more here to this passage than meets the eye. There's a polemic here. I want to talk a little bit about this drought, and this drought frames the Elijah story for the next couple chapters. And what he says here, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve," which is very specific wording and kind of unusual, and it draws attention to it. Now, the pagan God that Elijah is going to find himself in the most conflict with, the prophets of the pagan God that he's going to be in conflict with, is the god Baal. This is one of the Canaanite chief gods. He has a couple of different names, but he's known largely in the Bible as Baal, or Baal, if you wish. And he has a number of duties, and one of them is to bring rains upon the earth. He's the god of fertility, and he brings water upon the earth to bring life in the pagan Canaanite tradition. Now, when a drought happens, what seems to be the case, as far as we can glean from Canaanite texts, is that periodically Baal had to submit to the god of death, known as Mot, M-O-T. And this submitting to the god of death was sort of like a death for Baal. And when he died like this, his absence would then cause a drought. And when Mot revived Baal and returned him to his domain, then rain would return. So the Canaanites would interpret a drought as sort of the death of one of their primary gods, death of Baal. So if you look again at that passage, that Ahab is making a very specific point. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, there will neither be dew nor rain in the next few. He's saying that, you know, it's not that Yahweh is dying, that he cannot bring the rain, but rather this is a choice, this is a plan, this is part of Yahweh's intention to not bring rain. Likewise, when he says, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain." So Elijah is saying, I'm in service to Yahweh. I'm not controlling this. I'm not making Yahweh not bring the rain. And that's significant too, because in the pagan tradition and pagan culture, and we often forget this because it's so far removed from us anymore, we no longer see it, but people could also have control or influence over their gods. A prophet or a priest or a king could make a decision about something they wanted to see happen, and then they would endeavor to encourage the god to make it happen. In fact, this was a large part of the motivation behind child sacrifice, the idea being that if you killed something that was that precious and that close to you, that you would encourage the god, sort of through this sort of sympathetic magic, to make sacrifices then for you. And this is also the reasoning behind the prostitution cults in the Canaanite religion, that these ritualistic sexual orgies were sort of to encourage the gods to bring fertility and upon the earth as well. So this kind of idea of sympathetic magic and sort of manipulating or encouraging the gods to get them to do what you want them to do. Elijah is also pushing against that. Not only is his God not dead, but also Elijah is the servant. God is in charge. Elijah is not encouraging or causing God to do this. So right there you have this pushback against these pagan thoughts and beliefs, and we might not catch it because, of course, we're not living in a pagan world in that sense, so we don't see these sort of polemical things. And I think that contained within this sentence, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there'll be neither dew nor rain," is the repudiation of two worldviews that's still at work today outside of a pagan Canaanite context. The repudiation of the view that God is absent, and that is why these bad things happen, or that God is not necessarily absent, but just uncaring or unwilling to act in this world, sort of an agnostic sort of view, and it's on us to make sure that the world turns out the way we wish it to. That's sort of similar to the sympathetic magic view of the Canaanites. But as Christians, we reject those two views. It's not that God is absent. It's not that God is dead. God is there, and there is a plan that is being enacted. And it's not that it's on us to make sure everything turns out okay. It's not on us to make sure that the world turns as it should and that the stars are set in the heavens, or even that salvation be worked out. That's not our responsibility. God lives, and we serve God. God lives, and we serve God. He is alive, he has a plan, and I'm trying to get on board with that plan, even as Elijah did. And as Elijah, I will go before kings or paupers. I will eat well or starve. It matters not, even as it didn't matter to Elijah. God lives, and I am his servant. Such is Elijah, and when our faith is strong and our will is good, such should we be. Anyway, moving on. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kereth ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there." So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. The first thing I want to say about that is just, it's I think that's just a very typical experience with Yahweh, and resonates in my life too, that one day you'll find yourself standing in the court of kings, and the next day you'll be starving in the wilderness. There's a good deal of adventure in following God. Even in my life, which I think is aptly described as kind of a standard middle-class American life in a Midwestern town, I have to say I'm not bored following Jesus. It just seems like there's always something going on, and always some change of circumstances. So at any rate, Elijah finds himself, first he's kind of a nobody, apparently, or at least in the text he's not significant at all, and then he's in Ahab's court admonishing a king, and then presumably because the king is angry with him or people are after him, Yahweh sends him out into the wilderness to be fed and given water out there. Just as a point of interest, and this doesn't really have any spiritual significance to speak of, but I found it interesting. There's a possibility that he isn't really fed by ravens out there in the wilderness, as the text says. It says that the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And Yahweh says, "I've directed the ravens to supply you with food there." And that's possible. That the text reads that way. It's entirely possible that's what happened. God knows that Elijah's life was full of amazing things. This won't be the most amazing thing we read in the next few weeks. It could very well have been miraculous intervention like that. So that's possible. On the other hand, it's a little odd because ravens are, in the Hebrew text, considered to be ritually unclean. which means, you know, if you touched one, you couldn't go worship right away in the temple and whatnot. And so it's a bit strange, the choice of bird here. And then there's the other matter. I'm not sure if I'll be able to attach this to the podcast as a PowerPoint, but if I can, I will. And the other matter has to do with just the word itself. This Hebrew word, most Hebrew words are built on three consonants. And this one is ayin, resh, and bet. Basically, A, R, and B. And as many of you know, vowels weren't added until much, much, much later than the text. Hundreds of years later, in the Masoretic text, they added vowels to it. And those little dots and points you see in Hebrew letters are vowels. But initially, it didn't have any vowels. It was just consonants, and you had to sort of fill in the vowels according to context. And, you know, just knowing what was being said. Well, there's another word with that root, the ayin resh bet root, and that's Arab. It means sort of dark-skinned one. You could see we might get that from why ravens would have the same root, meaning dark. And so the word Arabs does appear in the Hebrew Bible and a couple other places. It has different vowel pointings, but it's basically, if you take away the vowel pointings, it's the same word. So it's possible that they might be talking about a dark-skinned people here, or specifically Arab people of Arab descent. And we do note that part of Israel had a number of different ethnicities and groups in it at this time in history. It was kind of, in fact, most of Israel is kind of a mixed bag at this point, ethnically. So it could have actually literally been a dark-skinned people or Arabs that were, you know, Bedouin types, if you will, living in the wilderness, who were providing him with bread and meat. And that kind of also makes a little more sense in the context of the next person who's going to provide food for Elijah is a person, not an animal, but the widow who lives at Zarephath. So on balance, I'm kind of inclined to think that when the textual scribes who put vowels into the text chose the word raven, I mean, obviously that's a miraculous and an amazing story, and they probably thought that's in keeping with Elijah's chain of events and character. But it could very easily have just been sort of a dark-skinned people living in that area who were providing for Elijah at Yahweh's command. And also my final point in this, I've gone on too long, I know, but also that's also the area where Elijah is from originally. If you look, the area of Gilead where he's, the text tells us he's from, which is the only thing we know about him, this particular Kereth Ravine is in that same area. So he may have known some of these tribes and groups. God basically sends him back out to the boonies, back to his home, and says, these people will provide for you. So at least that's my reading of it. It could be ravens. That's possible, but it seems in context it's probably likely to just be sort of a dark-skinned tribe that was helping to take care of him out there. Okay, so let's go ahead and get into the story, and then I'll just have a couple of things to say about the story, and then we'll carry it on again next week. So Elijah goes into that area of the Kereth Ravine, and he's fed by ravens, if you wish, or dark-skinned people out there. Sometime later, the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, and stay there. I have directed a widow there to supply you with food." And this is significant as well, because this is Zarephath in the region of Sidon is deep into Canaanite territory. These are not Israelites. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," there's that phrase again, she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first make a small loaf of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, 'The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land." She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse, and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" "Give me your son," Elijah replied. He took him from her arms and carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, "Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself out on the boy 3 times and cried out to the Lord, "Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him." The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son is alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth." And we look at this juxtaposition here, and we see the story begin with an Israelite man attempting to strengthen the walls of a city by murdering his own kids. His own Israelite kids. And we see the passage end with a man of God, a man after Yahweh's own heart, literally prostrating himself before the Lord, stretching himself out on the boy 3 times in anguish, in care, in compassion, to save a boy's life who's not even Israelite. He's from a pagan family. And that's the juxtaposition we find ourselves in time and time again in the Bible when it comes to Yahweh and his servants. Elijah knew what it meant to be holy and to follow the Holy Spirit and to really, truly, genuinely care about people, regardless of who they were or where they were at or what their beliefs were or anything like that, that he truly cared about them. And in fact, I think that last sentence of this passage, "The woman said to Elijah, 'Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth,'" the trust that she suddenly has in him as a prophet of Yahweh, I think there was maybe some skepticism or some suspicion on her part before that Elijah was just using her as kind of a way station, a place to hide out while the king in Israel searched for him, that maybe he didn't really care about her or would drop her in a heartbeat when the wind shifted. And it's this incident here, the care that he shows for her son, that really seems to convince her that this really is a man of God, and a man who's willing to put himself in harm's way on her behalf as well. So that's the nature of walking with the Lord. And it's, in my view, it's just one of those tragedies of a misunderstanding of the Bible, a misunderstanding of history, that a lot of people think of, the God of the Old Testament as this sort of cruel and capricious, harsh overlord who just is waiting for us to trip and screw up so he can smite us. And the prophets show us an entirely different story, a different, a God of compassion, and certainly a God of anger. When people kill their own children, for example, there's judgment that comes with that. But nonetheless, compassion, forgiveness, and the desire to see others' lives go well, that is all part of the prophetic tradition, and it's not something we should hold lightly as Christians. So I could go on. I have more written here, but I think that's enough for today. I think I've already spoken for quite long enough. Thank you for listening.